If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelt. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the cock. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Line engine, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast is a monthly podcast alternating fortnightly with its stablemate, the Martian Drive-In Podcast. Paleo Cinema looks at movies more than 20 years old in a wide range of genres and tries to find the cool, obscure or forgotten cinema of the past and brings it to your attention. Feedback is important, so please leave reviews on iTunes, email feedback, either written or MP3 attachment, to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru with a K at gmail.com. Or if you are in the USA, you can leave voicemails on area code 206-203-3299. This podcast contains coarse language and adult concepts, so you know it's going to be good.
Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 113. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I've decided that I'm going to do a couple of musicals where actors who can't normally sing indeed sing. So how is everybody? We're doing pretty fine here. In a couple of weeks we are going to be in tropical Darwin, drinking out of coconuts, wrestling crocodiles, enduring the end of the wet season and the torrential rain that comes with that, and in general having a great time. Looking forward to it a lot because we haven't had a proper holiday in a couple of years. So that's really great. I will be catching up with my old mate Ivor Cole up in Darwin, and Ivor and I will be doing an encore of films with Frost while I'm up there, which I'm really looking forward to. I'm also looking forward to catching up with Ivor and his wife Casey and just in general having a good time up there. We're up there for 8 days. We're going to have a car and a swimming pool at the hotel, and in general just having a really, really great time. Both of us love Darwin and we're looking forward immensely to getting back there. In fact, I might even, if I have a little bit of time, because I now have a new toy, record another Paleo Cinema while I'm up there, just to have one in the bag. So that might be a bit cool, sitting underneath the palm trees with the rain coming through and the sounds of the Arafura Sea bashing against the shore. Yeah, I think I might do that because basically I think it would be a very cool thing to do. So I'll have to get the two movies lined up and see what can happen there. It might be just a little bit of fun. The reason I can actually do that at the moment is that I have a new toy which we're taking up to Darwin with us, partly so I can do some of the university studies online. But I have a new netbook computer which doesn't have a CD or DVD drive or anything like that in it. Very small profile. I'm actually recording on it right now, so the sound quality is good enough for what I need to do. And it's got Windows 8, which has a little bit of a learning curve, but it's not really as bad as people make out it is. So no problems there. I'm not using the apps part of it very much, except to play games. And it does have a touchscreen on the laptop, which is kind of interesting, but I don't actually use it because it's not really useful having a touchscreen on a laptop computer. Particularly for the things I do, which are mostly writing and, of course, recording audio. I am doing a lot of stuff towards the secret project, the kind of book I'm noodling around with, but I kind of got stalled on that because I had another project I had to do, which was I had to give a talk at a Melbourne science fiction interest group at a local library. The group's called the Nova Mob. It's been going for about 30 years, and they wanted me to do about an hour on the current state of genre film. So I put together about 5,000 words on it, and did that. It was a lot of fun. I do have audio of that too. It's a little bit rough, but at some stage I'll be cleaning it up as best I can and editing out the dumb bits and uploading it at some stage. But yeah, I kind of went through genre films as they are now, the way the industry's changing, the way the delivery systems change for movies these days, and a lot of other things like that. It was well received. Pissed off a couple of people by dissing George Lucas, but somebody has to. And it was a nice mental exercise, but it kind of did put me off track a little bit for the book, so I'm getting back on track with it. I'm going to take, as I said, the netbook up there with me to Darwin. I've got a little time at either end of that time away as well, where I can really start hitting it a bit seriously. I've got about 15,000 words at the moment. I'm not sure any of them are good yet, but I'm kind of slowly in my head getting the format that I want for it nailed down. And that's not a bad thing at all. Let's see what the tally is. Just changing subjects suddenly. The tally for the number of movies I have watched so far in 2013. It's now up to 111 movies, which is not too bad given that it's still March. But let me just go into the old Mizo and see if I've got anything that's worth mentioning there. For those of you who don't get the Martian Drive-In podcast, I also did another podcast recently. I did an episode of Hammockus with our old friend Brian, and we talked about The Mask of Dijon with Eric von Stroheim in it, and that was a bit of fun. Just had a bit of a shoot the shit thing, had a little bit of enjoyment out of that, and it was nice to catching up with Brian as well. So you can go over to Hammockus, just type Hammockus into a search engine, and you'll find Brian and I shooting the shit about a really obscure movie about a mad magician. So let's see, what have I been watching? I watched Artists and Models, the Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis movie, which is kind of a bit of fun. Very vivid, eye-popping Technicolor, which I always like. There was a little bit of a groovy thing. I did see Devil Girl from Mars again. 1950s English science fiction thing with Patricia Laffin playing a woman from Mars who's come to Earth to basically fuck up our shit. Based on a stage play, which is interesting. But that's a classic too. I've got a recommendation to make though. This is probably the go-to for the last 2 or 3 weeks. I did see a nice little a zombie film, called Cockneys vs. Zombies, which is a bit of fun. It's about a couple of young guys who do a bank robbery and go in, and everything happens in the bank robbery, and it kind of fails a bit, and the coppers are outside, and then they come out, and the coppers are being attacked by zombies. There's a pit full of zombies that gets revealed during the reconstruction of some buildings, and a zombie outbreak in East London. And it's a lot of fun because there's a lot of really well-known and fun English actors in it. Honor Blackman, who people might remember played Pusha Galore in Goldfinger, is in there as well with a machine gun. Old chicks with machine guns. Her, Helen Mirren, really works. And, and it's a little bit of fun. It's nothing too heavy, but a nice little souffle. And it's worth your time to check out Cockneys versus Zombies. A lot of fun there. Let me have a look here. I did see Jack Reacher, the thing with Tom Cruise in it. And Tom Cruise is just really starting to piss me off because he's basically the same guy in every movie. He's not willing to step outside of his comfort zone. He's not willing to have his hair cut differently for any movie. I think it would have been better with somebody taller in it, because Jack Reacher, the character from the Lee Child novels, does have about a foot on Tom Cruise. And Tom Cruise trying to act tough, for some reason, doesn't come across. There's something soft about him as a persona. Yeah, he tries to be tough, and he does go through the motions of being tough, but there's a sense that he's trying too hard. There's a little bit of the short man syndrome happening there, I think, with Tom Cruise, whenever he tries to be a tough guy. I really think that it's you know, he's an interesting thing. He's an incredibly popular actor. And he's in this one niche. And it doesn't matter whether he's doing a science fiction film or whether he's doing an adventure film or anything, or whether he's doing a spy movie. It's all pretty much of a muchness. And I think that, yeah, it's really, I think, I mean, his personal weirdness rolls into that, of course. But, yeah, I mean, see it if you want to see it. Don't see it if you don't want to see it. Let me see, what else have I watched? Did see another good zombie movie, two good zombie movies. This one's called The Dead. I know that Mail Order Zombie have reviewed it. It's actually set in South Africa with an American military guy basically surviving a plane crash in a zombie outbreak in Africa. Things don't end well, I'll give you that much. I'll give you that much of a spoiler. Things do not end well. And shit gets really serious, but it's interesting watching African zombies, you know, kind of lurching across the veld rather than urban zombies. It does give it a bit of a different feel, and there are some very good, well thought out, well scripted and well directed action set pieces in this film that really do make it worthwhile. I don't think the budget for it was incredibly large, but they do convey what they're trying to do very, very well. So that's about all I'm going to tell you about what I've been watching. You can follow me on, you know, look it on Facebook or Mizzo. If you type in Cult Guru and Mizzo, you'll be able to follow pretty much all I'm watching. And I'm going to take a break. And, oh, geez, I haven't told you the movies yet. Okay, here we go. I am doing two movies with actors singing badly in them. First one is 1955's Guys and Dolls with Frank Sinatra and all singing or dancing Marlon Brando, Gene Simmons and Vivian Blaine in it, based on the Frank Lesser, A. Burroughs play from the early 1950s, and again based on some of Damon Runyon's short stories. And the second one I'm doing is a great big bombastic, over-the-top, larger-than-life, all-singing Clint Eastwood and Lee Marvin movie, Paint Your Wagon, from 1969, which again has virtues but isn't a perfect film. So I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I think I'm going to do Guys and Dolls first.
Hold me close and hold me fast, the magic spell you cast. This is love your roses. When you press me to your heart, I'm in a world apart, a world where roses bloom. And when you speak, angels sing from above. Everyday words seem to turn into love songs. Give your heart and soul to me, and life will always be love your rose. Quand elle me prend dans ses bras, elle me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose. Elle est entrée dans mon cœur, une porte de bonheur. Dans Jean, je connais la cause, je connais la cause. C'est elle pour moi, moi pour elle dans la vie. Elle m'en l'a dit, l'a juré pour la vie. Et dès que je l'aperçois, alors j'ai sans émoi mon cœur qui bat.
That, of course, was Jack Nicholson singing La Vie en Rosa from Something's Got to Give in 2003. It's not the first time Jack Nicholson sang in a movie. He did do a little bit of singing in On a Clear Day You Can See Forever 33 years before, which was a forgettable and forgotten Barbara Streisand movie. So, on ya, Jack. All of the music in this particular podcast is going to be from people who don't normally sing. So let's have a look at Guys and Dolls. It's a 1955 MGM movie based on the 1950 stage play based on short stories by Damon Runyon. It was directed by Joseph L. Mankiewicz, and I was just looking through Mankiewicz's IMDb. Here's some of the movies he directed, which are kind of interesting. The Ghost of Mrs. Muir, which is really a recommended movie of mine. All About Eve, I've talked about that before. Julius Caesar, the one with Louis Calhoun, and Marlon Brando playing Mark Antony. Guys and Dolls, of course, are quite American, so he did work again with Brando. Suddenly Last Summer, Cleopatra, which was the one that almost killed the poor bastard. The Honey Pot, which is a movie with Rex Harrison in it. I've got a DVD of that, but I haven't watched it for a while. And his last movie that he directed was Sleuth, the one with Laurence Olivier and Michael Caine in 1972. So, yeah, really a fine director who unfortunately worked with Elizabeth Taylor on two occasions. But, so basically it's a musical. The musical was really, really successful. It nearly won a Pulitzer Prize for the writers of the musical, who were Abe Burrows and Frank Lesser. The problem was that Abe Burrows was being investigated and wasn't really friends with the House Un-American Activities Committee. So that year, rather than giving out a Pulitzer Prize for musicals or whatever they did a no award year because of that political pressure. Otherwise, they would have given it to Guys and Dolls. Originally, it didn't have Marlon Brando and Frank Sinatra in it, of course. The original version of the musical had Robert Alder, Alan Alder's father, and a guy called Sam Levine, who you might see in a couple of small but very good films. Sam Levine was the guy who played the cop in the Thin Man movies with William Powell and Myrna Loy in the 1930s, for instance. Good character actor, did some really fine work. He was in Crossfire and Brute Force in a couple of good film noirs in 1947. A few other bits and pieces, but unfortunately wasn't in the movie we're talking about today. Instead, they got Frank Sinatra. Of course, Frank Sinatra can sing, so it's a no-brainer to get Frank Sinatra in a musical playing Nathan Detroit, the guy who's trying to get a crap game together and who is dodging the prospect of matrimony from his girlfriend, Miss Adelaide, played by Vivian Blaine, who played the role in the original Broadway play. Then you've got Skye Masterson, the out-of-town gambler who comes in and gets into a bet with Nathan Detroit, played by Marlon Brando. Now, Marlon Brando was hot shit at the time of this film. I'll just tell you the movies he did immediately before he did Guys and Dolls, just to give an idea. This really is an incredible run for an actor to have in his first years in cinema. In 1950, he played a crippled guy, a guy in a wheelchair, in a movie called The Men, which brought him to people's attention. Of course, on stage in Broadway, he was Stanley Kowalski in Streetcar Named Desire, and he redid that for the movies as well. Really one of the iconic roles. It was Terry Molloy, of course, in On the Waterfront. He played Emiliano Zapata in Viva Zapata. He was Mark Antony and Julius Caesar. He was Johnny in The Wild One. He played Napoleon Bonaparte in Desiree. And then suddenly, after having that gangbuster string of roles, he decides he's going to do a musical. Now, Marlon Brando is one of those guys that couldn't hold a tune in an iPod. But I kind of like him singing in this movie. It's one of those converse things. This is Brando at the peak of his power. He was a great-looking guy. He was charismatic as shit. He was really a charismatic actor. And you can see that in this film. He really does. The bet, I've got to explain the bet. The bet that he has, Skye Masterson has with Nathan Detroit in the movie, is that he can take a kind of Salvation Army kind of girl to Cuba for the weekend with him. And her name is Sergeant Sarah Brown, played by Jean Simmons, who I have talked about before in Paleo Cinema. She was the femme fatale in a movie called Angel Face with Robert Mitchum. But in this one, she's playing a Salvation Army kind of girl, very repressed, very forthright. She's trying to get people into their mission in Broadway in New York, and they're not having too much success with it. So Sky Masterson takes this bet from Nathan Detroit that he can get this repressed and very religious woman to go to Cuba with him for the weekend. And he does. But I keep coming back to Brando singing and dancing. I'm just going to play a little bit of Marlon Brando singing from Guys and Dolls just to give you a bit of an idea of what I mean by this. When they did record his voice, they actually had to use bits and pieces from different takes to get the full songs, because Brando wasn't really at his best warbling.
About you right now. Your eyes are the eyes of a woman in love, and oh, how they give you away. Why try to deny you're a woman in love, when I know very well what I say. I say no moon in the sky ever lent such a glow. Some flame deep within made them shine. Those eyes are the eyes of a woman in love, and may they gaze evermore into mine, tenderly gaze evermore into mine.
And what about you? It's got you too. Your eyes are the eyes of a man who's in love.
That same flame deep within made them shine.
Your eyes are the eyes of a man who's in love.
Woman in love.
Into mine, crazily gaze evermore into mine.
The female voice in that bit was Jean Simmons doing her own singing as well. Again, she wasn't known for being a singer, but that was kind of sweet. But the weird thing about this, and I find this weird, is that there was a hit version of the song, which became a great success in record sales and things like that, and it's a totally different version than the one in the movie, and it's not sung by either of those two actors. I'll just play a little bit of it to show you the difference between the two.
Your eyes are the eyes of a woman love. And oh, how they give you away. Why try to deny you're a woman in love?
That's Frankie Lane's version. I don't think it's anywhere near as good as the Marlon Brando Gene Simmons version. I really don't. But back to the movie for a second after that little digression into the house. Really bad pop songs that were on the charts in the 1950s could be. They really had trouble casting the movie. Well, not trouble, but there were some interesting choices that didn't get made in casting the movie. Marilyn Monroe wanted to play Adelaide, but Joseph L. Mankiewicz didn't want to work with her again after All About Eve. And he pretended never to have got her phone messages. They were talking to Betty Grable to play it. Judy Holliday was also being considered for the role. Gene Kelly was going to be Sky Masterson originally, but MGM refused to loan Kelly to the Goldwyn part of their organisation. And let's see, there was another one as well, which I found really kind of interesting. The Salvation Army worker, Sarah Brown, the role that went to Gene Simmons, was going to be played by Grace Kelly. They really wanted to have Grace Kelly doing it, which would have made the dynamic really different, because I don't think Grace Kelly playing a Salvation Army worker would really work much, even though she was really good in The Country Girl, playing a kind of not very glamorous role. But, yeah, and the movie looks fantastic. The kind of Broadway Times Square area that they created in studio for the film is really spectacularly good. It's filmed in eye-poppingly great Technicolor. The colours are enhanced, of course, because it's a larger-than-life world based on Runyon short stories. Everybody talks in the future tense and don't use contractions, and there's a lot of kind of gangster slang, which Runyon actually knew about because one of his best friends was actually the accountant for Dutch Schultz, who got killed in an attempt on Dutch Schultz's life in about 1930. So Runyon knew these kind of characters and enhanced and kind of embellished their slang and the way they lived and things like that. And the whole movie basically is set in a world of petty criminals who are into gambling and cons and pickpocketing and that kind of low-life stuff. But he gives them a kind of mythic enhancement, which came across, of course, in the stage play and then again in the movie. A lot of things are in primary colours. Everybody's wearing exaggerated clothing to a slight extent. This costume design is very good in the film. And the sets are just mind-poppingly brilliant. They really did go to town. I just found another casting thought that they had for the film. Dig this. Clark Gable as Sky Masterson, Bob Hope as Nathan Detroit, Jane Russell as the Salvation Army Sarah Brown, and Betty Grable as Miss Adelaide. But, Marlon Brando actually played a few tricks on Sinatra as well during the filming of the movie. In their first scene together, Sinatra's got to eat some cheesecake, and Sinatra didn't like cheesecake, so Brando kept flubbing his lines deliberately, so Sinatra would have to keep eating cheesecake until finally they had to give up for the day because Sinatra was sick to the stomach of eating cheesecake. And Brando later said, interestingly, about Sinatra, "Frank's the kind of guy who, when he gets to heaven, is going to give God a hard time for making him bald." So, that's... But I really do like Brando. This is one of the Brando roles that I really like. I mean, I do like him in Last Tango in Paris. I think he shows an immense vulnerability in that one. But this is probably the first movie that Brando ever did where Brando was having fun. And there's a really nice sequence, a tango kind of sequence in the Cuban scenes in Guys and Dolls where Brando and Gene Simmons and a few other people are dancing. And Brando is having a great time with it. It ends up in a bar brawl. But really, Brando is just enjoying himself a lot. And it's something that seeing him in heavy roles like Last Tango in Paris and The Godfather, Missouri Breaks, and all those other things that we know him for, which are very much more serious roles, On the Waterfront, Streetcar Named Desire. Seeing the guy be playful, which from all accounts he was kind of a bit of a practical joker and didn't take his career as seriously as a lot of other people wanted him to. It really is nice to see him play with this. And he does outshine Sinatra. Sinatra's kind of diminished in this role. He's not the kind of confident, brash Sinatra that we know from later movies and other parts of his career. But no, I'm not saying he's bad in the film, but I just think that I'm watching the film again last night. I was really waiting for more Brando to come on screen. And then, of course, you've got the supporting cast as well. Vivian Blaine's very good as Adelaide. Got Regis Toomey playing the head of the Salvation Army chapter. You also have Stubby Kaye, of course, playing Nicely Johnson, who gets a couple of really good songs in the film. Stubby Kaye, there's a connection between the two movies I'm talking about, actually, this time around, which is kind of interesting. Stubby Kaye was also in Kapaloo, which starred Lee Marvin, who is in Paint Your Wagon. So there's a causal, there's a connection between the two films. But Stubby Kaye was also in a number of other things. He was really good playing Marion Sam in Little Abner, another musical from the 50s that I really like, because apart from anything else, it has people like Julia Newmar and Stella Stevens and Leslie Parrish in it. But there were these kind of bright, brash musicals, adaptations of Broadway successes, like Little Abner and Guys and Dolls, and of course later on West Side Story and another of other films, which really were great. The other one, other aspect I've got to mention too, while I'm gushing about this, and you know I'm going to gush about things at various times, is the choreography. Michael Kidd did the choreography for the original stage version of Guys and Dolls in 1950 and won all sorts of awards for it. And he adapted his choreography for the movie version as well. And there's some great scenes. I was watching the scene which ends with Brando singing Luck Be a Lady. And I'm going to play a bit of Brando singing Luck Be a Lady, where they kind of set it up with a dance of the guys playing craps in a sewer. And it's really great. They turn the game of playing craps into an abstract ballet. It really is kind of all the movements and all of the necessary actions to play craps are kind of abstracted and enlarged. And there's a great dance sequence there, which is among the great dance sequences that Michael Kidd did for cinema. There are a number of other ones as well. You might remember that Michael Kidd was one of the stars in one movie too that I really like, which was It's Always Fair Weather with Gene Kelly, Sid Charisse, and Dan Daly. He was the short guy Angie in that movie as well. And he also did all of the choreography for Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, which is really great. And my joke at the moment is that the choreography for Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, particularly the Lonesome Polecat dance sequence, had a big influence on the axe dancing that happened in Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. Watching Abraham Lincoln slinging around that axe reminded me a lot of Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. But it's just a good musical. It's a confection. It's a bit of froth. It's nothing serious, but you've got really beautiful sets. You've got good actors. You've got dance sequence with women dressed up in cat costumes in a nightclub, which is never a bad thing. And you've got Marlon Brando really having fun. A lot of people don't like Brando, and of course, it became a bit of a punchline in the late 1950s in movies like Bells Are Ringing, with Frank Gorshin playing a Marlon Brando-type method actor in Bells Are Ringing, the Dean Martin-Judy Holliday movie from about 1959. But, there were a lot of people that took off Brando's mumbling and things like that. But in this movie, I really love Brando playing. He's playful and he's really having a good time with it. And I enjoy that. I mean, it's not politically correct at all, this film. Now, having a bet on whether you can take a woman away for a weekend is probably considered a little bit crass these days. But in the context of the time and in the context of the play and the fact that she goes with him for her own reasons. And one of the things about Jean Simmons that's kind of underplayed in a lot of her movies is that she was a very sexy actress, particularly doing the dance sequences in the Cuban scenes in Guys and Dolls. She was quite understatedly hot, which is kind of something that I didn't really notice until I rewatched the film again last night. But that's about all I've got for Guys and Dolls, apart from I'm going to play Marlon Brando singing Luck Be a Lady, a song which later on Sinatra adopted for his stage shows. But I think that Brando's version is my favourite because I do like you've got to see the video clip and it's on YouTube. But Brando in this sequence is dynamic. I mean, he uses all of his stagecraft to put it across, even where the singing isn't the best. And it really is one of the magical sequences for the movie. It's one of those scenes that you wait for if you rewatch the film.
They call you Lady Luck, but there is room for doubt. At times you have a very unladylike way of running out. You're on this date with me. The pickings have been lush. And yet before this evening is over, you might give me the brush. You might forget your manners, you might refuse to stay. And so the best that I can do is pray. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck, if you've ever been a lady to begin with, luck be a lady tonight. Luck, let a gentleman see how nice a dame you can be. I know the way you've treated other guys you've been with. Luck be a lady with me. A lady doesn't leave her escort. It isn't fair, it isn't nice. A lady doesn't wander all over the room and blow on some other guy's dice. So let's keep the party polite. Never get out of my sight. Stick with me, baby, I'm the fella you came in with. Luck be a lady. Luck be a lady. Luck be a lady tonight. A lady wouldn't flirt with strangers. She'd have a heart, she'd have a soul. A lady wouldn't make little snake eyes at me when I bet my life on this roll. So let's keep the party polite.
Why don't he shoot?
Why don't he shoot?
Never get out of my sight.
Come on, we're stalling.
Stick with me, baby, I'm the fella you came in with. Luck be a lady.
Guys turning yellow.
Luck be a lady.
What are you scared of?
Luck be a lady tonight.
Somewhere in the night, chasing shadows around the bend. But in my lonely flight, I'll keep searching till time is through. Just somewhere in the night, till I find you.
Was George Chakiris singing a song which was the theme tune to a TV series that starred George Maharis, being Somewhere in the Night, which was the theme to Route 66, the TV series starring George Maharis. I kind of like that version of it. It's a little bit pop and crackly because it's recorded from vinyl, but it's kind of cool. And again, actor singing, though George Chakiris did sing in French in a movie I talked about a long time ago in Paleo Cinema Podcast, being The Young Girls of Rochefort, the Jacques Demy musical starring François Dauriac and Catherine Deneuve. And on to the second movie, Paint Your Wagon, from 1969. Now, I'll be the first person to admit that Paint Your Wagon is not a successful musical. It's incredibly large, cost $20 million to make. It made its money back, but it's really over the top. And there are enormous crowd scenes for musical numbers, and it's just crazy, this movie. It's too many people were smoking dope when they made it. And not something I'm likely to say about a lot of movies, but on the other hand, this one really went over the top. But now, having said that, and the music is by Lerner and Lowe, based on the musical Paint Your Wagon from the 1951 stage musical by Lerner and Lowe, set in a mining camp in Gold Rush era California. It stars Lee Marvin, Clint Eastwood, Gene Seberg. It also has Ray Walston, and it does also have Harve Presnell. Now, Harve Presnell, I like in this film, even though he's only got a few scenes. I really love Harve Presnell in this movie. Harve Presnell, you might remember, played the kidnappee's father in Fargo, the Coen Brothers movie. Many, many years after this one, when he was a lot balder, portlier, and older. Now, Harve Presnell wore wigs in this movie and also in another movie called The Unsinkable Molly Brown, which was a Debbie Reynolds musical. Harve Presnell had a great singing voice, and I like him a lot, but it's the people without the good singing voices that make this film really interesting. Lee Marvin, Clint Eastwood, and Gene Seberg. Basically, the story is that a wagon crashes into a ravine, and a kind of grizzled prospector, Ben Rumson, played by Lee Marvin, finds two adult men, a pair of brothers, in the crashed wagon. One of them's dead, the other one's got a broken arm and a broken leg. They're about to bury the first guy. Fortunately, it wasn't just the guy with the broken arm, broken leg, played by Clint Eastwood. And as they're digging the grave, they find gold dust in the soil. Ben stakes a claim and adopts the surviving brother as his partner while he recuperates. And there's a gold rush suddenly, and a great big boom town springs up called No Name City. And the guys are quite successful, and Ben Rumson and partner come to an agreement where Ben tells partner, and this is one of the great acting scenes in this movie. And to be honest with you, it's one of the best acting scenes I know of in a Lee Marvin film. Even though Kapalu was the one that he got the Oscar for in this one, he's cutting a deal with partner about, you know, partner's still laid up with a broken arm, broken leg, and Ben's mining the gold on their behalf. And Ben says to him, and I'm paraphrasing badly, you've got to see the original scene to get the full value of this, that when he's lying drunk in the mud, partner's job is to pick him up. When he gets melancholy, which he does sometimes, partner's job is to be his friend during that time and to look after him. And as Lee Marvin's saying that, it's heartbreaking. It really is. It's in the middle of this great big bombastic over-the-top ridiculous musical. There's a kind of really tender and open moment where we learn almost everything we need to know about Ben Rumson as a character in this small bit of dialogue between Lee Marvin and Clint Eastwood. And Marvin just is awesome in that he shows his range as an actor, which is not something he was able to do, I don't think, enough in his career. He was drunk through most of this, making of this film, apparently. And again, that's hearsay. And of course, he had problems with alcohol. I've mentioned this before when I've talked about Lee Marvin in Paleo Cinema. He lived through extraordinary circumstances. He was in the Battle of Saipan and severely wounded in the Battle of Saipan during World War II when he was only a teenager. And later on, of course, he became an actor and things like that. But there's a strong evidence looking through the career and the life of Lee Marvin that he did suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. What we now know is that, which at the time would have been called shell shock. But Marvin, in spite of that, was an immense presence in cinema. I mean, you got Point Blank. He's really good in Bad Day at Black Rock as one of the bad guys. Of course, he's in The Big Heat, the Fritz Lang film in 1953. Great as a comedy drunkard in Cap Ballou. Really broadly comedic. And, yeah, he's an iconic character. He was fantastic in The Dirty Dozen as well, playing the sergeant. Just one of those great icons of cinema, which is why back in the day, early in Paleo Cinema, when I did my alternative Magnificent Seven, Lee Marvin was in there. A really fine actor, really strong actor, much, much, much more talented than even he gave himself credit for. But there are two scenes in this film where you see the best of Lee Marvin's acting. And watching it, and again, I watched this one last night as well, stayed up until 2 in the morning to finish it. There are two bits in this scene film. The first one, of course, when Partner and Ben cut their deal. And the second one where, and I've got to tell you the rest of the plot before I get to that. Basically, a Mormon comes into Nam-Nam City and he's got two wives. And there's a certain antagonism between the wives. And so the Mormon guy decides, because this is a lawless territory, it's not a state yet, there's no law in Nam-Nam City, decides he's going to auction off one of his wives, the one who, Elizabeth, played by Gene Seberg. And there's a streak of cruelty in this Mormon guy in the way it's set up in this film. Whereas his other wife has a suckling child. Jean Seberg's character, Elizabeth, her child died a month ago. And the Mormon guy basically says she's been really shitty. And he doesn't say it in these words, but he says she's been really shitty since her child died. And he's a greedy bastard at the best of times. And he auctions her off like they would a gold mining claim. And drunk and not really realizing what he's doing, Ben wins the bet. And suddenly he has a wife, and their marriage agreement is a mining claim. It's the equivalent of a mining claim because that's the only law that there is in Nam-Nam City, the law of mines. So the marriage is set up as a mining claim. Not the most politically correct thing they could do, but it's the way they've done it in this film. And there's a piece in The Wedding Night where Ben and Elizabeth are in his tent and discussing their relationship, and they're negotiating what both of their needs are in the marriage, which is a very unusual marriage because of the way it's set up and the fact that Ben hardly knew he was doing it at the time. And the dialogue is beautiful, and the way it's played by both actors, Gene Seberg and Lee Marvin, is really tender, really vulnerable, and really nice piece of acting and a nice piece of cinema. There aren't that many really nice pieces of cinema in this film, but those two scenes, the one between Ben and Partner and the one between Ben and Elizabeth, really do show some incredible acting by Lee Marvin. So I'm just going to leave that there. Just watch for those if you do decide to see the movie, because they do make it worthwhile. It's a very long film. It runs 154 minutes when I think it could have been trimmed and a lot of the extraneous shit taken out. But that's great. But then, of course, we come to the singing. Now, there is a great song called A Million Miles Away Behind the Door, which Gene Seberg gets to sing as she's moves into the cabin that Ben and Partner have built for her, which I kind of like. But and of course there's the other aspect of this as well before I get into the singing. Ben and Partner end up sharing a wife, the exact reverse of the Mormon situation. And they kind of, the three of them decide to have a design for living, kind of like the old Noel Coward play in the 1930s movie, where they basically share a wife. And the three of them live together. They all, in some way or other, love each other. Between Ben and Partner, of course, it's a blokey kind of love, not sexual at all. But, so they move in together. But, of course, as civilization encroaches on Nam-Nam City, that builds up certain tensions and ends up in the disintegration of the relationship. But this has got to be the first polyamorous Western musical that there was. And they treat the idea with respect. You've got to remember, it's the 1960s. It's a Summer of Love was a year before. People were open up to new possibilities. And none of this is in the original stage play, none of the polyamory side of things. In fact, I've just read through the synopsis of the stage musical, and it's very, very different than the movie. I don't think it's any better or any worse. It's just very, very different. Now, the singing in this film, there is, of course, the iconic song which Harv Presnell sings, and which is really, really good. And again, it's one of those nice songs in the sense that one of the functions of a song in a musical is to give you an info dump on the nature of the character singing the song. It's a shorthand for telling you about who this person is. And in this movie, Harve Presnell plays a character called Hard Luck Willie, who's a gambler, and a very successful gambler, hence the ironic name. And the scene is that it's been raining for days and days, and the clouds are blowing through, and the wind's blowing through, and nobody can get out into their mining claims to dig up the gold, and everybody's getting a bit stir-crazy. And then, of course, you get this great song coming up.
The rain is Tess, the fire's Joe, and they call the wind Mariah. Mariah blows the stars around and sends the clouds a-flying. Mariah makes the mountains sound like folks were up there dying.
So you've got that powerful song, strong voice, good acting, and then we cut to Clint Eastwood doing this.
I still see Elisa, she keeps on returning, as breathless and young as ever. I still hear Elisa, and still feel a yearning to hold her against me again. Her heart was made of holidays, her smile was made of dawn, her laughter was an April song that echoes on and on. Since I saw Lisa, the shadows are falling, and winter is calling above. But I still see Lisa. Whenever I dream,
see what I mean? It's not his best moment in cinema, is it? But it's really interesting to watch him being way out of his depth. Normally we associate Clint Eastwood as an actor with somebody who's in control of the situation he's in. The Dirty Harry movies, pretty much anything else he's been in, right up to Gran Torino. But in this one, he is out of his depth, and his emotional reactions, such as they are, and they never were, he's never had a broad range as an actor, do seem to be kind of a little bit off. He's, to be honest with you, up until he became a fairly good director, Eastwood wasn't that great an actor, really. And this movie does show that. And the differences, maybe he learned something from Lee Marvin, who knows, but the differences between him and Lee Marvin in this film are remarkable to watch. It's always good to watch the bits that don't succeed in movies as much as it is the bits that do. And just that dissonance between the two is kind of interesting to behold. But and then, of course, you've got the third person in the thing being Gene Seberg, incredibly tragic life. You can read it up on Wikipedia or IMDb. I'm not going to go into the details, but she died at the age of 40 at her own hands. Ostensibly, though, there were some doubts about that, and you can go and discover that stuff for yourself. But I really like Jean Seberg as an actor, apart from the fact that she was a very beautiful woman. Things like she was in Bonjour Tristesse, the Otto Preminger movie she did just after St. Joan for Preminger, a movie with David Niven and Deborah Carr in it, set in the south of France. Very good movie. She was in the French Style with another actor I like a lot, Stanley Baker, in the early 1960s. A great actress and a really interesting presence in cinema. And then, of course, she did Breathless with Jean-Paul Belmondo, really, you know, part of the French New Wave. And she did work a lot in France as well. She was a lot better respected in France than she was ever by her own country, or if you look into the history of her life, by her own government. But I do like Jean Seberg in this. She shows a presence and a gravitas that I really find interesting. And her character, Elizabeth, is very strong. She knows what she wants, and she is the instigator of the ménage à trois that forms the centre of this film. Her character is. It's her decision to have two husbands, very much so. And in fact, she's the, in a sense, the emotional core of the film to an extent, and does very well in it. I mean, this movie was a disaster in a lot of ways. It ran over budget. There were immense production problems. The scale of it's enormous. There are hundreds and hundreds of extras. All of the hippie community from Portland, Oregon, basically, is in this film. Thousands and thousands of hairy, shaggy, rambunctious guys around the place. The Nitty Gritty Dirt Band plays in the movie, for instance, doing one of the songs. And they build a whole wooden boom town, which is later destroyed in the making of the film, on the banks of this small river. And there are crazy scenes in the film. Like, there's a scene where Ben Rumson, the Lee Marvin character, goes off and kidnaps a wagon full of French whores because there aren't enough women in No Name City. And just, you know, the bit where they bring the whores back to town is kind of an interesting and over-the-top thing. They have this wagon careering across the prairie and driving up the creek bed, and they have a band playing La Marseillaise to greet these French whores who end up in No Name City, and it's a band full of Chinese guys playing Chinese instruments, playing the Marseillaise on Chinese instruments. It's just a crazy, over-the-top film, and the scale of it is crazily big. It's kind of like somebody decided, this was made before then, but it's very much kind of like McCabe and Mrs. Miller as a musical in some ways. Really crazy, over the top, but some of the acting, as I said, Gene Seberg in particular, Ray Walston playing a Scotsman with a slightly dodgy Scottish accent. A number of the character actors in the film are great as well. Harve Presnell as Hard Luck Willie is great as a kind of presence there. This movie is one of those ones that I really wish was better than it is, because I think there are some elements to it that I really, really appreciate, but it's kind of like it's an overinflated tire. It's bound to burst somewhere, and it bursts in a number of places because of that. But having said that, I really do appreciate the film for those little bits. And in fact, some of Lee Marvin's singing in the film, particularly the track I'm going to play in just a moment, became a hit in Australia. Wandering Star became a big hit in 1969 on the charts in Australia. And then I think there was a number of reasons. One, it's Lee Marvin, and Lee Marvin had an association with Australia at the time. He used to come to Australia to go deep sea fishing off the coast of Bermagui in southern New South Wales, a town I love as well. Bermagui is one of my favourite places along the coast. Really nice town with a little boat harbour and some mountains in the background. fantastic fishing there. And it was one of Lee Marvin's favourite places as well. He used to go up to Cairns as well, but he did some fishing at Bermagui. And because of that association with Australia, and because Wandering Star is a song that anybody, doesn't matter how tone deaf and with whatever range of voice you have, is able to sing, anybody can croak along with Wandering Star. It became a big hit at the time, and it's kind of not a bad song either, which I kind of like. So I'm just going to play us out from Paint Your Wagon with Wandering Star. Like I said, the movie is flawed as all hell, but there are some interesting bits in it, and it's nice to revisit it now and then.
Seen a sight that didn't look better looking back. I was born under a wandering star. Mud can make you prisoner and the plains can bake you dry. Snow can burn your eyes, but only people make you cry. Home is made for coming from, for dreams of going to, which with any luck will never come true. Goodbye forever, it's time for me to go. I was born under a wandering star. A wandering, wandering star.
What can make you prisoner and the plains can make you dry? Can burn your eyes, but only people make you cry. Home is made for coming from, for dreams of going to, which with any luck will never come true.
Heaven, tie me to a tree, or I'll begin to roam, and soon you know where I will be. I was born under a wandering star.
See what I mean? Anybody can sing along with that song. Anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to get some feedback happening for us all.
I can see the question in your eyes. I can see the twitching of your ears. Now it's not to be repeated, but gentlemen, be seated, and I'll tell you where I've been for all these years.
If he's very nicely treated, and we have his toddy heated, he'll tell us where he's been for all these years.
I was out on the blue Pacific with a cruiser of the fleet, hopping over the side for me Saturday dip.
Go on, go on.
When I noticed a Jap torpedo whizzing by beneath my feet, coming lickety split and headed for our ship.
Fancy that.
So I stopped her with me left, and I turned her with me right, and I aimed her very careful, and I shoved with all me might, and I sank the subwatt center, and I roared with righteous wrath. Oh, that's what you jolly well get. That's what you jolly well get. Disturbing me Saturday evening bath.
Hooray! He's won the war.
He's won the war.
He's won the war.
But I'm modest to the core.
Hooray! He's won the war. And though he's rather shy,
I'm terribly, terribly shy.
He will admit he's won.
I was captured around Benghazi by a Nazi regiment after polishing off half a thousand or more.
He's barmy.
And it took them two pairs of tanks to drag me into the general's tent, where they started to search the uniform I wore.
My word!
When they took away my gun, I was pleasant as could be. But then they took a letter what my sweetheart wrote to me. So I bashed their bloomin' brains in, and I lived to tell the tale. Well, that's what they jolly well get. That's what they jolly well get for reading a gentleman's private mail.
Oh. Hooray! He's won the war. He's won the war.
And I won the one before.
Hooray! He's won the war.
I hate to tell the tale,
but I'm giving my barrel of ale.
Was having me leave in London back in 1941, having breakfast in bed at a fancy address.
Oh, yes?
When a Jerry come by and dropped a bomb what must have weighed a ton. It was difficult to collect myself, I guess.
I should think.
So to Croydon Field I ran, and I upped a plane from there. Now, I couldn't tell who'd done it. There were thousands in the air. So I shut down all the blighters, and I told them all, you see, that's what you jolly well get. That's what you jolly well get for splashing a gentleman's cup of tea.
Hooray! He saved the day. He saved the day.
In my own quiet way.
Hooray! He saved the day.
I always zips me lips.
But dream of fish and chips. And he'll confess he saved the day.
To this most heroic gent, be on to erect a monument
and put it in Trafalgar Square, where he can enjoy the open air.
That was Errol Flynn from Thank Your Lucky Stars from 1943 with That's What You Jolly Well Get. Okay, we've got feedback, so just give me a moment to bring it up here. Got an anonymous one that came through on the Paleo Cinema website, paleo-cinema.blogspot.com, and it says, Terry, I just discovered your podcast, and I feel the same way about the Baedeker Westerns, Baedeker and Scott Westerns. Fantastic. I'm going to write in more, but for something I've been into a lot as a cartoonist and writer myself are the early EC comics. They were from the early 1950s too, and the storytelling and visual compression and intensity of them seems to relate for suspense and horror and social commentary, etc. Also really dug the zombie in a lonely place analysis, and the mad, 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 mad world was great too. I'm not a didact cinetaste, having cut my teeth on indie screens in Manhattan in the 1980s, Theatre 80, St. Mark's, Thalia, Regency, etc., as well as some in London in the late 70s, Ritzy Brixton, screen at the Green and Electric Cinema with a bit of Fawcett's Mulching Meeting in Chicago. More soon, and please keep it up. And that person didn't put their name in there, so just throw a name in next time. Really like to know who you are, and we'll see what we can get. But thanks for the feedback on that one. And yeah, I mean, I cut my teeth too on the 1970s marginal cinemas around Sydney. One of the things I'm going to try to put into the book is a lot of stuff about that, as best I can remember it. But yeah, I misspent my youth in darkened auditoria like that, watching cult films. I saw The Wicker Man there. I saw a lot of Hammer horror films. I saw the Ginger Trilogy with Sherry Cafaro, and a lot of blaxploitation stuff as well. So a lot of us came through that, just watching those movies. They were cheap to get into. I got into them illegally at times because I was under 18 to see R-rated films. But yeah, that's very much where I came from as far as my early cinema taste is concerned. And I'm revisiting a lot of that stuff now and find it still interesting. Though there are a few of them that I wonder what the fuck I was thinking when I liked them. But thank you very much for that. But please send your name. I'm more than happy to read out any comments, but we kind of need to engage that if we can. I also got some feedback from a new friend, Morris, who's in Melbourne. By the way, Morris, we do need to catch up. I know that. We've just got to work out a suitable time after work to do that. This one says, "Hey, Terry, shame on me and all else for not providing you Paleo Cinema feedback, so here's some for you. I listened to the new Paleo Cinema covering the Barbetica Westerns and actually watched Ride Lonesome a few weeks back after you posted on Facebook about your new appreciation of these films. I have to admit that I was never a huge fan of the old-style Westerns, as distinguished from any I've seen in the 70s onward, like the Missouri Breaks. And maybe this is why Ride Lonesome didn't appeal to me so much. Having said that, I really dig classics like Shenandoah and High Noon. I've yet to see Rio Bravo. Ride Lonesome was certainly interesting thematically, revenge, friendship, hidden agendas, but some of the dialogue just didn't ring true to me. For instance, that instance you quote, for example, between James Coburn and Pernell Roberts, where Coburn expresses surprise that Pernell Roberts held his friendship in high esteem, seemed more like dialogue one would hear between schoolgirl kids rather than two hardened outlaws from the Wild West. For some reason, I have no problem with awkward dialogue in film noir, but in westerns, it just grates on me. Anywho, now that I've gone and displayed my ignorance, I'll just sign off. Despite my feelings about that film, I really enjoyed hearing your perspective. I like that you discovered these films you were previously unfamiliar with, and despite years of film watching, they got you excited. Cheers, Morris." Yeah, thanks, Morris. With the dialogue between Pernell Roberts and James Coburn, I think the fact that it was schoolboy dialogue made it kind of interesting. These guys aren't educated, they're not very communicative, and I think that what Bert Kennedy did with the dialogue was to show the boy in the man a little bit. Now, maybe that's my reinterpretation of it after reading your email, but I did that kind of weird innocence about it. I found really engaging the fact that they weren't aware of how close they were, or at least one of them wasn't. I found it kind of intriguing, and I found it a very masculine and male kind of approach to things. But having said that, you know, I can understand that other people have different interpretations of films. That's one of the things that makes it really interesting. But thanks for that, Morris. And people should go and listen to Love My Album, Morris's podcast as well. He gets in guests from everywhere and talks about an album each episode, a lot of which I don't care for, but I do listen and I do appreciate where they're coming from with the material, even if I don't necessarily engage with it the same way that he and his guests do. I also got another email. Yes, see, three in a row. Whoa, we're starting to get feedback. I do appreciate this. It's from Ken Krimstein in Illinois, America, near Chicago, and he says, "Brewer cold. I have a few minutes, so I thought I'd tell you how much I've enjoyed dipping into the podcast, discovering Dr. Zom. All your missives, I've cracked up at your joint podcast about the chick flicks today. Funny stuff. I appreciate the way you appreciate films, and I echo the audio vote from a listener in Cleveland. This is a community and a passion. Remembering some of the films I've seen, but not for a while, discovering new ones, and connecting to a visual of Oz. I worked for a spell in Hong Kong with a bloke from Melbourne via Tasmania. Anywho, movies. Well, I'm totally grokking your vibes and passions. I love how you said you enjoyed getting outside of your familiar lair and discovering films. I think that's a great way for us cinebuffs to connect. I agree totally. I'm fascinated with language. I'm trying to pin down your While the City Sleeps review. If you really want some obscuring... I'm fascinated with Lang, and I'm trying to pin down your While the City Sleeps review. If you really want some obscure and cool Lang, his House on the River is divine and creepy. I believe Scarlet Street and A Woman in the Window are epochal, and I think everywhere you turn with Lang, I love your praise on the Mabuses, there is God. I personally believe Hangman Also Die could be the greatest war movie ever, because it's about people, zero sentimentality, but total sentiment. Lang was a tough man, but a tough and maniacal humanist like Kubrick. By the way, I just went to the screening and discussion by an amazing Chicago film critic, Jonathan Rosenbaum, on Full Metal Jacket. Hadn't seen it since it came out, and it was a scratchy 35mm print. Holy shit, he called it Kubrick's most avant-garde movie, and not far wrong. It's kind of sort of blown away Apocalypse Now, except for some of the vibe from the director's cut. By the way, I loved your discussion on the Luton films. Other passions of mine that may take you places: Herzog, Werner and his documentaries, even Fata Morgana, of course Aguirre, but the early films, all of them. I love his concept of ecstatic truth that is essential thinking. You also dipped into Ophuls, I see. I haven't had a chance to catch up with your discussion of, I believe, La Ronde yet. For my money, Letter to an Unknown Woman is about as good as Hollywood ever got. When you think about those Euro directors and writers in Hollywood, it's truly fascinating. Renoir's later films, of course, and his earlier films. I guess it would be all of his films. Well, this is humanism to rival The Archers. By the way, for your amazing exegesis, there's a misspelling 25-cent word for you, of Colonel Blimp was marvellous, but Renoir's The River... from Rumour Garden. Let's see. Lest I seem too high, but I think that I never laughed so hard as I did at the end of something called Call Me Bwana. And I do love what you did with It's a Mad, Mad, Mad World and Tati. We're talking about Jacques Tati. But his widescreen film, the name escapes me at the moment, the one that broke him. Well, I checked out the criterion and the notes are by my man Rosenbaum. I think that is, it's either Parade or it's Traffic. I'm not sure which one. Okay, and he goes on, funny, well, producers, The Producers, Airplane, Animal House. I'll dig into Your Bedazzled and The Yearlings, of course. I've always had a soft spot for the one about the captain with his wife on the other side of the Strait of Gibraltar, Captain's Paradise and Passport to Plimlico. Well, anyway, a long-winded way of saying keep it going, and maybe someday I'll try to do an audio thing. This is making my fingers tired. Best, King Crimson. He's got a website, fishwithlegs.com. And P.S., he loved my thing on Pepe Le Moko. It was sent from his iPad, so that's probably one of the reasons why it gets a bit staccato, because mine gets staccato when I type on my iPad as well. Okay, thanks for that, Ken. Yeah, there's so much stuff out there. That's one of the things that keeps me going with movies, is the fact that I keep discovering new stuff. I mean, I want to look into more of Ophuls. I want to look into things like Lola Montez and stuff like that. Just finding them sometimes difficult, sometimes dead easy, but sometimes difficult. And Renoir, I've got Rules of the Game, but I haven't had a chance to watch it yet. I should put it to the top of my list because it's on the top of everyone's list. But I'm going to check Rules of the Game out. There's just so much. And every now and then, you know, you kind of dig away at a thin vein of movies. And then suddenly it all opens up and you've got a whole vast range of films to enjoy. Kind of the way I did with the Baedeker Westerns and a few other things. And I want that too. I want to keep finding new things. And I think that there's such a vast amount of cinema out there for more than a century now that it's not impossible that you can keep going forever. They're making new European films, for instance, that I don't know anything about. I've got a tag on a copy of a Serbian story, but I don't think I'd necessarily want to see that. I kind of, these days, and maybe it's a function of racking up a few birthdays, and I've got another one coming up before I do the next Paleo Cinema as well. It's a function of that I'm looking for the movies, now and then I hit a kind of movie that I find really joyous. Ones that kind of, you know, give you that love of life again. And you don't find too many of them because it's a hard thing to do accurately and it's a very subjective thing to do as well. But every time I watch things like The Young Girls of Cherbourg, for instance, and a few other films, I kind of get that joie de vivre about things and it boosts you up again. It's like an adrenaline charge to your mind rather than your heart. And that's what I'm looking for more in cinemas. Yeah, there's other things like the Bedecker Westerns and finding those tiny moments in Paint Your Wagon where Lee Marvin shines and watching Brando step out of his comfort zone in Guys and Dolls. I kind of live for those things in the cinema. I really like them a lot. And just, you know, sometimes you've got to dig through a lot of stuff to find the joyous ones and the cool moments and all of that kind of stuff. But it's worth doing and it's worth us all as a community and as a planet recommending things to each other. Nobody knows everything about this stuff. Everybody's got their own subjective cinema world. And what we're doing here is we're revealing little bits of it and sharing it so that we can enrich each other's entertainment in a sense. I mean, this stuff, none of this stuff's going to cure cancer. None of this stuff's going to cause world peace. But what it is going to do is get us through the dark times. It's going to keep us amused when we need to be amused. Life does have its pressures, and this stuff is a safety valve for that. A good film will get you through another day when you need to get through another day, or it'll be something you can share with your friends and laugh about or groan about or talk about for the next 2 or 3 days. It's all of that stuff, and we all can now do it together, and that's the beauty of this stuff. Sharing things, finding new things, sharing that joy of discovery and adventure in cinema. And that's what we're all doing, be it me, be it the B-movie cast, or Hammickus, or 1951 Down Place, or Mail Order Zombie, or Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, or Silver and Gold, or any of those great podcasts out there. And, of course, people are doing it in television as well. People are doing it on YouTube channels, just sharing the love. And it's a noble cause. I mean, yeah, we're out there tilting at windmills with this stuff and risking ourselves in a weird kind of sense by putting our opinions out there. You're always going to take the risk when you have an opinion and you put it in a public domain of people bouncing back and attacking you for it. Haven't had too much of that happen yet, fortunately. But it's always out there, the fact that we're putting ourselves out there. And even people who write in or put in voicemails to podcasts are risking censure in some ways. But our intentions are always good. We're out there to share the love of it, to share the enjoyment of it, and to just groove on the groovy stuff that people have spent years of their life making. So having had a little bit of a gush there, I'm going to end it now. I'm going to send this off into the universe. And next time around, I'm going to try to record it in Darwin just because I like the idea of sitting down on the veranda of a little tropical villa surrounded by palm trees and a swimming pool and casting my pod. So I'll be back next time. 2 weeks from now, I've got another Martian Drive-In podcast, which I think will be a solo one that I'll get a guest in again. It's just because of this timing of the holiday, it's a bit difficult. I do want to get, as I said before, Rupert Pupkin in to do another Paleo Cinema. I'm going to try to line that up sometime in April. But take care of yourselves. Enjoy your movie viewing. And I will be back with more gushing about films fairly soon. Catch you later and take care of yourselves.